MacCast, Tuesday, March 31st, 2015. This episode of the MacCast is brought to you by lynda.com, the online learning platform with over 3,000 on-demand video courses to help you strengthen your business, technology, and creative skills. For a free 10-day trial, visit lynda.com/MacCast. That's lynda.com/MacCast. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, I have a great show for you today. We've got lots of Apple and Mac news to discuss, a lot of updates on the Apple Watch, what the buying experience is going to be like. We're getting close to being able to put in those pre-orders and make our try-on appointments and stuff like that. I'm starting to get excited about that. Some updates and rumors surrounding Apple TV. Also, Apple's been on an acquisition spree lately, mostly surrounding the cloud. We're going to talk about that. Some updates to the iOS and OS 10 betas and some things going on with Apple's music efforts, along with some new rumors surrounding the next generation of iPhones and what have you. Then we're going to get into a little bit of feedback. I'm going to talk about choosing the right band to go around, along with your Apple Watch. We're also going to update you on those damages to some of the Retina MacBook Pro screens with the screen coating coming off. And then I have a great interview. Our friend Michael Simmons from FlexiBits is back. They have a new product out. We're going to talk to him about that and just about the state of app development and marketing in general. So it should be a really great show. Stay tuned. Hang out with me. But before we get started, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is lynda.com. You know, lynda.com, it is for problem solvers. It's for those of you who are curious, for people who want to make things happen. Maybe you want to master Excel. Maybe you want to learn new negotiation tactics, build a better website, boost your Photoshop skills. Go to lynda.com now, and you can feed your curious mind. They have great on-demand video courses, over 3,000 of them, and they're growing all the time. And they offer things that can help strengthen your business, your technology, and your creative skills. They provide courses that are great for all different skill levels, which is one thing that I love about them. Some of the courses I recommend you might want to check out. They're adding new stuff all the time, and I just pulled the latest and greatest, Shooting with the GoPro Hero. That is taught by Richard Harrington of Red Pixel. Great guy in the video and photography space. Really good course if you've got a new GoPro camera. I just picked one up for my drone, so I'm excited to check that out. WordPress DIY, specifically for weddings and special events. So if you're a photographer, you're looking to build a WordPress site, that might be a great place to start. There's a new course on iPads in education, specifically on deploying shared iPads. So if you're in IT and education, that might be a great course to check out. I know that can be pretty confusing. And there's new Prezi Essential Training. I know a lot of people use PowerPoint and Keynote, but Prezi is a great online tool for doing presentations, and they have a whole course on that. Now, one thing I'm particularly interested in getting into is iOS development at some point. I'm a web developer. I'd love to do more stuff with iOS. It comes up from time to time with my clients. I haven't had a ton of time, but because I have my lynda.com subscription, I can actually save things that I find as I'm browsing around and come back to them. So I've done exactly that. I created an iOS development playlist, which is something you can do on the website. And then when I find courses like Swift Programming Language First Look or Swift Essential Training, I can bookmark those, I can add them in there, and I can come back. And each course is actually broken down into little segments, and it saves your progress as you're going through them. So I can jump into a course, watch a little segment, and come back to it. You don't have to sort of consume it all at once. If you want to do that, great, you could do that as well. And plus, they have their iOS and Android apps, so you can even catch up on your mobile devices when you have time. So it's really flexible, and I think that's what really makes it great. So your lynda.com membership, trial membership, will give you unlimited access to all of the training on hundreds of topics. And once you subscribe, you get all of that access for one flat rate. So whether you're looking to become an industry expert, you're just passionate about a hobby that you have, or you really want to learn something new, I encourage you to visit lynda.com/MacCast to sign up for your free 10-day trial. That's lynda.com/MACCAST. Sign up today. I think you're really going to like it. And a big thank you to Lynda for their support of the MacCast. So let's get into talking about what's going on with Apple, specifically the Apple Watch. I think this isn't really surprising, but we're starting to hear rumors that, you know, getting an Apple Watch day one, those first couple weeks, just like with all new Apple product releases, it's going to be a little bit difficult. And personally, I feel that with any new Apple product these days, it seems like Apple can never keep up with demand. I think that's just the state of being popular, sort of being on the top of the heap in the technology consumer electronics space. So personally, I plan to pre-order my Apple Watch first thing on April 10th when they go on sale. I know a lot of people are recommending, you know, you probably want to try them on first, and I certainly want to do that. So I will also schedule a try-on appointment. But I feel like if you don't get in early, your chances of getting an Apple Watch day one are going to be lost. So if I end up going to my appointment realizing I made the wrong choice, and I think I've talked about this, I'm going to go with the Space Gray Black Sport Band model, the 42mm. And I think that's, you know, I don't want to really spend more than that. I really have my heart set on the Space Black version in aluminum and the sapphire, but in order to get that, you got to jump all the way up to the Sport Link band. It's almost $1,100, and I really don't want to lay out that much cash, but I certainly will try that on my try-on appointment, and if I suddenly feel maybe I made the wrong choice, well, then I will likely cancel my order the Apple Watch I want, and then, you know, wait a while to get it, I assume. But if a sketchy rumor out of China is to be believed, things could be even worse than I've been thinking, or maybe even you or I have imagined. According to a report on UDN.com, they say there are a couple of issues in Apple's Apple Watch supply chain that could cause some problems. They're citing critical issues in the manufacturing of the Apple Watch's OLED display that they say are resulting in, quote, perilously low yields. Apple has classically had yield problems with displays from their suppliers anytime they have kind of a new product or new technology. And this time around, this is the first time they're doing OLED. So it's not surprising that they might be having some issues. It's also being said that Quanta, who is the assembler, is having trouble with the assembly because of the device's incredibly small size. On the display side, they're claiming that just 30 to 40% of the displays coming out of the LG factory are usable. If accurate, the assumption is that Apple will only get a yield of about 1.5 million units a month. That's about half of the 3 million units that they really wanted. Now, I will say the report to me seems suspicious at best because both LG and Quanta have had great track records at supplying not just Apple, but other big-name consumer electronics companies. So it's not like they're new to this game. For example, LG is among the companies that first invented flexible OLED displays. So they've been making these things. They've been making them for other manufacturers. I don't see that it's all that different doing it for Apple, unless Apple's standards, which we have heard in the past, are just a lot higher than some of the other manufacturers. Maybe they're rejecting more displays or demanding sort of a higher quality level. Same thing on the Quanta side. It's hard to believe because Apple and Quanta have worked closely together for years. Apple has always been deeply involved in the process and tooling of the products, and Quanta is usually on top of that stuff in terms of Apple's production lines. But still, this is at least the second time we've heard a report like this, and it probably won't be the last leading up to the launch. We've heard about different production issues with the Apple Watch. For example, last week, Timothy Akuri, an analyst at Cowen and Company, said that Apple had to tap Foxconn and Samsung as additional Apple Watch suppliers to help get production yields up to more acceptable levels. So that's another thing that Apple often does to deal with supply chain issues. They have other vendors and suppliers lined up so they can quickly switch and adapt and bring additional resources on board if they think they're not going to be able to reach that production demand. But I think we can fully expect that things are going to be a little bit slow, a little bit tightened and constrained at first, and then over the weeks and months following the launch of the Apple Watch, that'll all pan out. Apple will get the supply chain leveled out, and it'll get to sort of that normal churn that they always get to with new products. I mean, this is a brand new product for Apple, so I think these sorts of things are to be expected. For you and I, just what it means is, like I said earlier, if you really want an Apple Watch early, day one, you want to get it on the 24th, you're going to have to actually make some effort, be online, probably pre-order, and risk maybe not getting exactly the watch or model that you want if you want to have it day one. So even though we have no Apple Watch at this point, another thing, interesting thing happened this week. We started to see apps become available that have Apple Watch support. So you can download the apps in the App Store. Developers started rolling out their compatible apps, but you're not going to have any way to sort of view them. I guess if you can load them inside, if you're a developer, you can maybe load them inside the developer app and take a look. But apps like Evernote, Twitter, Dark Sky, Things, and Target, they started servicing this past week, noting that they have Apple Watch compatibility. Really, the only way to tell is to look at the release notes, the update notes. They list different features in the descriptions on the App Store. I personally fully expect that once the Apple Watch actually is released, Apple will add a little badge or some sort of indicator or icon on the App Store for those apps that are actually supporting the Apple Watch, and we'll be able to tell a little bit easier which apps are going to be in there. But right off the bat, it's seeming like we're going to get a lot of app support. There's a lot of excitement around the Apple Watch and the release, and it sounds like a lot of developers are really committed to being there day one with updates to their apps. So I think we're going to have no shortage of things to check out when we have our new Apple Watches, and that is pretty exciting. Another thing that we're getting more details on as we get closer is the whole buying experience with the Apple Watch. We already know that one of the things you'll be able to do is make an appointment to do try-ons. You'll be able to go into the Apple Store, but we didn't know what that experience was really going to be like. We're starting to hear rumors that those appointments are being scheduled in about 15-minute intervals. So you're going to go in, you're going to get about 15 minutes with a consultant. They're going to allow you to try on different versions. What I read was you're only going to be able to try on the stock bands and combinations that Apple has sort of already announced. So you're not going to be able to really mix and match. It's going to be a somewhat limited experience. That is, unless you're ordering one of those, you know, $12,000, $10,000, $17,000 Apple Watch editions. We're hearing that those folks are going to get, and really rightfully so, right, a little bit more customized, a little bit more personalized experience, a little bit longer experience. They're saying those appointments are going to last 30 minutes. And I would really hope that Apple, if you're spending that kind of cash, is going to give you as long as you want with a sales associate to make that purchase decision. But we'll have to see. Apple is also trying to give their employees a little more information and training in terms of telling them that they want to have them focus more on style and fashion of their buyers and play into that aspect of the buying experience more so than the technology or the price points that customers might be thinking of plunking down to get an Apple Watch. They have been given a list of suggestions, according to 9to5 Mac, that tell employees that they should make comments that appeal to the buyer's style, making comments about why they think it would be a good option or a good choice for one watch over the other, again, based on style and just the whole look and feel and sort of attitude of the person that's buying the watch. They're saying that they should explain how earlier customers made similar buying decisions between models and use other accessories that the customer already has on as examples of where one model or one style would look best for that customer. If the customer is with another person, they're being encouraged to make sure that they get the opinion of that person on which model should be purchased. And they are really being encouraged not to focus on price as a reason for recommending an option, because many customers might be willing to spend more on a particular model, specifically if it makes them feel good. So playing more into the feelings and emotions of the purchase rather than just some of those more practical decisions like the technology that's built into the watch and those sorts of things. But I think that's always been sort of the part of the Apple buying experience, you know, that feel good. I feel good about the model that I'm purchasing. It's the right model for me. Apple's done that with iPhones and iPods and those different kinds of decisions, and a lot with Mac purchases over the years. If you've ever bought a device or a product in an Apple store, you probably had a similar experience. It's sounding like they're being told to focus more on that part of the experience, though, with the Apple Watch. Another thing that seems obvious is they're also being asked to focus on how the customer plans to use the watch and who they may be buying it for if they're not buying it for themselves, and how they plan to use it. So with so many different materials and band combinations, again, I think this really makes sense. You know, is the person going to feel better with a leather band or a metal band versus maybe the elastomer band that is offered in the sports model? And then another thing that they're being told is to try and push iPhone upgrades. Specifically, if someone comes in, maybe they're not already an iPhone owner, you do need to have an iPhone to use the Apple Watch. And that gives the employees an opportunity to maybe leverage the new Android trade-in program that Apple's going to have in store to kind of convert Android customers over to the Apple platform. And employees are also being given the ability, and this is something that they've actually already always had, but they're being encouraged to use their ability to check an iPhone customer's upgrade eligibility and maybe upsell them on a newer model iPhone at the same time that they're buying their watch. Again, a customer's pocketbook may not be able to support that, but it makes sense that Apple would want to try and upsell as much as possible and get the most cash out of that transaction as they possibly can. Some people may not like that sort of little bit higher pressure sales tactic, but you know, I think stockholders and Apple's bottom line is going to benefit from that kind of selling experience. Like I said earlier, the Apple Watch try-on appointments are going to begin on April 10th, and purchases will be able to be picked up on April 4th. They'll be shipped, or April 24th, rather. They'll be shipped out on April 24th if you order them online. As far as the try-on appointments go, you'll be able to make those online, but it's also sounding like Apple will have some ability to handle walk-in try-ons without reservations, although I expect that those slots are going to fill up really, really quickly. And if you just walk into an Apple store, you might have a really long wait time to actually be able to get in and get scheduled for a try-on appointment. So I really think if you want one of those, your best bet is to go online ahead of time and actually schedule that. Mac Rumors also ran a report this week saying that when you go in to purchase, at least at first, you may not be able to do a walk-in purchase of an Apple Watch on or after the 24th. This really seems highly unlikely to me. I would think if Apple has a customer in store and they have the inventory available, the customer's ready and willing to make an Apple Watch purchase, they would still try and somehow fit them in, maybe make an in-store appointment, make it available so that they can actually make a purchase. But still, Mac Rumors is claiming that they've seen training documents that say customers must make an online product reservation to actually be able to hold a specific Apple Watch model at a retail store. So to that end, they're saying that walk-in customers will be offered a try-on appointment and then help afterward in placing an online order through the Apple Store app. But it sounded like then they'll have to come back for their actual pickup or product reservation appointment to actually get their purchase once it's available. And that may just be related to sort of the constrained supplies that we're hearing about. And the document also does note that try-on appointments are not the same as reservation appointments to pick up an Apple Watch. So two separate things. You're not going to be able to do a try-on appointment and then make a purchase that same day, which again seems a little bit weird and off. Again, assuming Apple has the inventory available, but I guess it may just not be there. So try-on appointments and reservation pickups are going to be happening at Apple retail stores at all the different countries they've announced for launch. We also heard that Apple was going to have some dedicated Apple Watch store within a store kind of experience at high-end department stores. They officially announced those locations, April 10th, grand openings for stores in London, Paris, and Tokyo. They're going to be at Selfridges in London, Galeries Lafayette in Paris, and Isetan, hopefully I'm saying that right, I-S-E-T-A-N, Isetan in Tokyo. So those will be all the places you can go in, try on, and pick up your Apple Watches. And I am super excited. I don't know about you. I can hardly wait. It seems like we've been waiting forever. We're literally just about 10 days away at this point. And hopefully Apple's system, online system, on the 10th at midnight holds up. And I'm assuming that's going to go live midnight Pacific time. And I'm sure we'll all be online together on Twitter and social media exchanging our experiences. But hopefully it goes very smoothly. And I'll just remind you, in the past, if you're trying to do this, I think most of us have had better luck using the Apple Store app than Apple's online store via their website. I actually usually have both of them up and try both locations for trying to get in and actually place my order. And this time around, we're going to be having to place those try-on reservations too. So expect Apple system to be doubly overloaded on that day. Last week, we were discussing the rumor that Apple is still trying to bring on a new streaming TV service, specifically by partnering directly with networks like ABC, CBS, and Fox. We'd been hearing they're having talks and that they're getting ready to announce something, possibly at WWDC. There were also these rumors that Apple was not holding talks with Comcast-owned NBC Universal because of prior talks that they had rumored that they were rumored to have had, where there was a big falling out between the two organizations. Well, this week, a Comcast attorney wrote specifically to the FCC to say that NBC Universal has not withheld any programming from Apple for any kind of new venture that they might be working on, which seems like a strange thing to do because it kind of potentially confirms that Apple is doing something. And they said, in fact, that Apple had not even approached them with such a request. So that second half starts to make you think, well, maybe Apple's not even working on anything if they're not approaching NBC Universal. But we've already heard these rumors about talks with ABC, CBS, and the rest. So it was a kind of weird statement. It seems to clarify and mostly corroborate what we've already been hearing. I guess the hearsay part is the why has Apple not approached NBC Universal, because it's sounding like it's not because of the fallout. Well, or maybe it is in Apple's mind, but NBC Universal saying, hey, we're willing to talk. So maybe that's all this is they wanted to put this out to the FCC to kind of give Apple a signal saying, hey, regardless of whatever happened in the past, maybe we do want to be part of your system. But I also read that there's a, because of how the Comcast NBC Universal deal went down, there is a clause. If Apple is able to secure programming and deals with the other networks, that NBC Universal may be forced under the arrangement that they had with the FCC to actually provide programming and content to Apple. So Apple may be trying to do an end run by getting a bunch of other deals done and then sort of forcing NBC Universal to have to come on board. So interesting things, nonetheless, happening with the Apple TV deals. And whether or not that happens, this week we're also hearing that there are renewed rumors about an Apple TV hardware update. Rod Hall at JP Morgan thinks Apple will announce a new Apple TV and also an app store to go along with it at the upcoming WWDC in June. Now, why? Well, he says that Apple wants a piece of the estimated $35 billion PC gaming market. So this is, again, this rumor that we heard in the past that Apple wants to bring specifically game apps to the Apple TV, turning it more into not just a TV consumption, you know, TV streaming box, but also a game system. He says that an Apple TV using the current iPad Air's A8X chip could be at least as powerful as a PlayStation 3. You add gaming and apps along with the previous rumored TV subscription service, and the Apple TV could end up being a very serious contender for the living room alongside other dedicated gaming consoles and set-top boxes, especially among, I think, the growing segment of casual gaming folks. This would be a huge play for Apple. It kind of disrupts two different markets. Apple and the iPad and the iPhone have already made some significant strides into just the portable mobile gaming space. And I find this very, very interesting. Now, Apple's A8 processor, not just the AX, was actually recently found to be capable of driving 4K resolution video. So even if Apple doesn't jump all the way to the A8X processor, if they go with an A8 and an updated Apple TV, it would still have some serious horsepower for gaming. And previous rumors also seem to indicate that Apple might be looking to load more than just the 8 gigabytes of flash storage that's in the current model. And the assumption would be that would be for game storage and app storage. So it makes a lot of sense. Adding living room gaming could be a big win for the consumers, too, who are already invested heavily in iOS games on their other devices. You add in support for things like Bluetooth controllers. You've got iCloud syncing of your saved game data. We've already got Game Center integration, and Apple already has a pretty good cohesive living room gaming experience. And then add on to that the other kinds of apps that would be possible on an Apple TV, things like news, weather, social media, photo viewers, all kinds of stuff. And I think Apple's going to be very careful about the kinds of apps that they allow onto the Apple TV. I think it's going to be a little bit more curated. They're going to need to make special versions of these apps that are going to be specifically designed for a television living room experience. And I think that'll be part of the announcement at WWDC. Maybe something Apple might call TV Kit for taking iOS apps and porting them over to the television experience. It's something I think it's been a long time coming, and I fully expect some sort of new Apple TV product this year. And I think definitely gaming and apps is going to be a big portion of that, along with hopefully this new streaming TV service. Speaking of streaming television services, good news for those of you in Australia and New Zealand. I guess Netflix finally landed down there for you. I don't know what's taken Netflix so long, but thank goodness you can now get Netflix. There's some great ads, I think, with Ricky Gervais that are airing in your countries. And along with that, that means that the Netflix app, is now available on your Apple TV. So if you're already an Apple TV owner, you're going to want to grab the latest updates, get the Netflix app, and you can subscribe to Netflix and watch on your Apple TVs. So that's really good news. For the rest of us, there was also a small update to Apple TV's channels this week. Three new channels added to the current Apple TV: Young Hollywood, Taste Made, and Ted. Finally, Ted on the Apple TV. Not really sure, again, what's taken so long for that, but very happy to see that there's some really nice, great content in the TED Talks, and you can now watch those on the big screen without having to rely on the app on your iOS device and using AirPlay, which worked just fine before, but it's nice to be able to just pull up the remote and grab that content directly. And it syncs across, and it'll work with your iOS apps as well, so it's nice and integrated, great integrated experience. I think there are several of us, myself included, who like to sort of tease Apple about their efforts in the cloud. And let's face it, we've got some good fodder. They haven't had the best track record in the world, but I like to think of it like sort of teasing a sibling about their inability to maybe use a yo-yo or something like that, kind of call them out on a talent they're not particularly good at. And Apple historically has not been that great at the cloud, although they are getting better, and I will have to say it's not for lack of trying. This week, TechCrunch reported that Apple acquired the database company FoundationDB. They wrote up a piece, and you database guys will probably understand what this means, but I have no idea what it means, claiming that they thought Apple wanted the FoundationDB company because of the speed at which their system handled ACID-compliant transactions and also the platform's strong scalability. They say in a company blog post, they suggest that FoundationDB could achieve 54 billion writes per hour, which which to me sounds like a lot. I mean, I'm a database guy, but I don't deal in that sort of high level enterprise sorts of transactions. But sounds like a capable system to me and something that Apple would want for their cloud efforts. Of course, when Apple was asked to comment on the acquisition, they gave their boilerplate response, which goes like this. Apple buys smaller technology companies from time to time, and we generally do not discuss or our purpose or plans. So there you have it. New database company, I'm sure it's going to factor into all kinds of different areas of their cloud efforts. Another thing that happened recently, although slowly over time and seemingly went unnoticed, was that Apple acquired a London-based big data analytics firm called Akamai. The timeline and the nature of the acquisition seems to be somewhat unclear, though Apple Insider noticed a story in Bloomberg this week, and they believe that it was kind of an acqui-hire sort of purchase, although it seemed to take place over the entire course of a little more than a year. Over the past year or so, Apple seems to have hired at least seven software engineers from the company, including the founding CEO and CTO, Tim Mortenson. The company's product is a real-time analytics platform that boasts high-velocity ingests and is compatible with Cassandra databases. Not really sure that Apple uses specifically Cassandra databases, but I would assume because it's an acqui-hire sort of situation that they're really looking for the engineers to plunk into their old system. And what exactly they're doing with the engineers is also somewhat unclear, but most of them seem to be landing in Apple's iCloud or other back-end data systems areas, which seems logical to me. Akamai's own products were specifically focused on building analytics and data analysis for things like banks, big financial institutions looking at financial market data, trying to understand different patterns and trading environments. They also said that they had systems for looking for anomalies and performing risk analytics in banking. So there could be applications, I think, for Apple within their Apple Pay system, potentially, although most of that stuff, I think, on the transaction side is falling on the banks. Apple could also be applying the technology or skills from these engineers to other services, things like iAds, tracking and analyzing customer buying behavior and trying to sell more accurate and more relevant ads to consumers or display more relevant ads to consumers. There's applications I would imagine in Beats Music in terms of curated and just playlists in general. Same thing with iTunes Radio, better iTunes Radio suggestions based on listener preferences, things like that. You have applications within the App Store suggestion and curation systems. So a lot of places where this technology could be applied. And yeah, it's always great for Apple to bring on more qualified engineers and people to their team. They're growing a lot of these parts of their cloud businesses. So, they again seem to be continually focused on getting good and some of the best people in the field of cloud and storage and online technologies. They just somewhat seem to have issues with bringing it all together. So hopefully more acquisitions, more new engineers, more technology is going to help them build a better system. And I think we are seeing some of the fruits of it. I think this latest iteration of a lot of the iCloud services, they've worked particularly well. I know over the past couple of weeks, we've seen some outages and downtimes, but everybody sort of experiences that. And I don't think it's a huge concern. I've been happier with more of Apple's iCloud services lately. I don't know about you, but it seems like things are getting better to me. And hopefully this is just more signs that things will continue to improve. There were a couple new beta updates to let you know about this past week. OS X 10.3 beta update, as well as iOS 8.3 beta updates. iOS 8.3 beta 4 came out. One interesting new feature in it, and something that I've wanted to see for a long time, is it now appears that you can use Siri to place a speakerphone call. So you can say to Siri, call a person's name on speaker, and it will immediately place that call and put that call on speakerphone. That'll also work with the new Ahoy Siri feature that is in iOS 8. So you'll be able to, that'll help out a lot, I think, in the car. There's a new toggle that will allow you to download free applications from the App Store without requiring a password. So that can be a lot more convenient when you're downloading those free apps. And then also in there appears to be a new category filter for iMessages that will allow you to see messages from your contacts separate from those people who aren't in your contacts, a section or a filter called Unknown Sender. That way you can go through those, maybe add people from there to your contacts list if they're relevant, or it might help also in finding any kind of messages that you may want to block the senders for. So that could be convenient. In OS 10.10.3 beta, some of the new things is version 3.0 of the Yosemite recovery partition and tools. And then also developers have been asked to focus on their testing of the new beta on things like the captive portals. That's where you go in and you access public Wi-Fi in hotels, airports, other public spaces. So they want them to check out that process, make sure that that's working. They've also been asked to take a look at the Photos app, which continues to improve, but still has some bugs, mostly related to the new iCloud Photo Library beta. I actually haven't played around with the iCloud Photo Library beta yet, mostly because of the storage. I think a lot of us have iPhoto libraries that are huge, and for Apple, that's a great thing because they're likely going to sell us more storage. I'm just not so sure I want to commit to that yet. But there you go, a couple of updates to the betas. I fully expect that we should see 10.10.3 and iOS 8.3 relatively soon. I would expect maybe around the launch time frame of the Apple Watch, but we're just going to have to wait to see. But it looks like those things are getting closer and closer to completion. The new MacBooks got a lot of attention after the Apple Watch event, and I think rightly so. There were a lot of things to talk about, including the controversy surrounding that new USB-C connector. I think we've talked over that quite a bit on this show. But another thing that Apple announced during that event was upgraded MacBook Airs, and we didn't hear a lot about that. There were some reports of people who were disappointed that Apple did not bring Retina displays to the MacBook Air lineup. Of course, we've got Retina in the new MacBooks, but some people even said that the new MacBook Air's Intel HD graphics chip, the HD graphics 6000 chip, was not powerful enough to support Retina graphics, which was really weird to me. And they were giving that as an excuse as to why we did not see a Retina screen update in that same upgrade. It's weird because the new MacBook has the lower Intel HD Graphics 5300 chip and, of course, supports Retina just fine. So it really wasn't surprising this week when Ars Technica came out with a report saying that they discovered that the new Intel Broadwell processors that are in the upgraded MacBooks, along with that Intel HD Graphics 6000 chip, they do support an external 4K display running at 60 hertz using DisplayPort 1.2. So if you have a DisplayPort 1.2 cable, you plug that in, it's perfectly capable of driving a 4K display. Though if you look at Apple's spec page on the updated MacBook Airs, they claim the max external display that's supported is a 2560 by 1600 display, so not 4K. Now, in order to achieve the feat, you do need to run the MacBook Air in clamshell mode, so it cannot drive the internal display and the external display. You have to run it with the lid shut. So that's probably actually why Apple does not tout the feature or support. But regardless, if you have a new MacBook Air and want to drive a 4K external display, it looks like you will be able to do it. You can even run it as a dual display setup, but you will experience some animation glitches and some slowdowns and things like that, according to the report on Ars Technica. So interesting thing to see there. And again, not surprising, because with the new Broadwell chips and the Intel 6000 graphics, should be a lot more powerful than the previous generation and more powerful than the MacBook. As we get closer to a possible relaunch of the Beats music service under the Apple brand, the New York Times has a story that seems to be offering a little bit more details about what we might expect. Basically, they're outlining a service that is going to combine the best of the Beats technology along with somewhat of an Apple style and maybe attitude revamp brought on by some of the players who were already working at Beats and who are now at Apple, most specifically Trent Reznor. They're saying that As far as the beat side, they're going to continue to focus on the curated playlists, which is a big touted feature of the Beats streaming service, the artist curated playlists. But then add in the vivid visual appeal, and that's a quote that is, you know, part of Beats, but fitting that into Apple's minimalistic aesthetic design. So I'm assuming that means a little bit of a cleanup, maybe a little bit more flat look, that sort of thing. We haven't really seen any specific leaked screenshots or anything like that. They also say, interestingly, that they're going to retain the Beats name. So I don't know if that means it'll be Beats by Apple, or if they're going to try and co-brand it, or they'll simply just retain the name Beats. They weren't really clear on that. And as far as when we will see it, they're supposedly saying it will be part of an iOS 8.4 update. Something we had heard in the past, too, was that Apple was looking to possibly reduce the monthly cost of the service down to about $7.99, but that was reportedly met with some extreme pushback from the record labels, so it's sounding like that didn't happen, and the service is likely going to retain its $9.99 a month pricing. We're also hearing that there's not going to be any kind of free ad-supported tier, so it's going to be a purely subscription music service, and that goes into label and artist royalties and things like that. It seems to be fanning out that most of the subscription music services that are on the market, the, you know, all-you-can-eat kinds of services, are winding up at around that $10 a month U.S. price point. As far as Trent Reznor's involvement, and for those of you who don't know, Trent Reznor was the former frontman of Nine Inch Nails, or I guess probably still is the frontman of Nine Inch Nails. I'm assuming they're still producing music. He was also the chief creative officer over at Beats. He's reportedly playing a major role in the redesign of the service. It's also being said that Apple is working hard to secure prominent album releases that will be exclusive to the Apple Beats service. That's always valuable in sort of driving people to your platform, getting people on board. There are also rumors that Apple is, in addition to revamping Beats, trying to revamp the iTunes radio product alongside the updated Beats service. So the two services are actually going to remain separate products. They're not going to be integrated or rolled into one at all. As far as the radio service goes, it's said to be getting more regionally tailored selections. So much more localized to your country, your region, and things like that. As a matter of fact, Apple hired former BBC radio DJ Zane Lowe, and he is supposedly helping out with that part of the effort. As far as when we will get some sort of announcement about an updated Beats and possibly updated iTunes radio service, again, that's being expected to happen somewhere around the WWDC timeframe. So think about June of this year. While last year's iPhone rumors seemed to be centered around phones getting bigger and bigger, and specifically iPhones getting bigger, there is rumors this week that Apple may be considering going the other direction this time around, at least on one iPhone model. Mac Rumors caught a DigiTimes report that says Apple plans to expand their iPhone lineup this fall with a new updated 4-inch offering. They expect the update to be the iPhone C line, and many are calling the phone the iPhone 6C. This would be in addition to updates for the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus, the iPhone 6S Plus in a 5.5-inch model, and the iPhone 6S in the 4.7-inch model. So retaining the current sizes for the iPhone and the iPhone Plus line, simply adding in the iPhone C line on the smaller size. And this really is welcome news for many buyers who have expressed a love for the 4-inch form factor and were really not happy with sort of being forced to jump up to the larger phone sizes if they wanted to upgrade. So if you fall in that camp, you may want to wait until this summer, when Apple will likely make some sort of announcement, or late fall, and then expect a fall release of the new devices. Right now, it's somewhat unclear what the specs of the new device might be, but because it's getting the C moniker, I think we can assume that it will be some sort of entry-level specifications and entry-level price point. And while the size might make some people happy, I would assume that some customers are not going to be totally stoked about getting the 4-inch form factor, but having to settle for more 5S like specs, but it is expected that the new iPhone 6C series would use an A8 processor and basically be a repackaged iPhone 5S design. It will have support for some of Apple's newer technologies, things like Apple Pay, possibly support for Apple's Force Touch display technology. That's rumored to be coming to the next generation of iPhones across the board. We've also supposedly seen some leaked back shell images showing the new polycarbonate case with a second row of speaker holes along the bottom, just like on the 5S design. And the camera is supposedly flush with the casing. So unlike the extra thin iPhone 6 and 6 Plus, which forced the iPhone lens to be, you know, that little protruding, what I called camera wart, this one is flush on what is rumored to be the iPhone 6C model. The report also claims that the updated iPhone 6C will be manufactured by a company called Wistron out of Taiwan. Now, I was unfamiliar with that company as an Apple supplier until I heard this report. As far as I know, Apple hasn't used them in the past, but they do appear to have done assembly work for Microsoft on their tablets and phones. So they definitely have experience. As far as I know to date, Apple's iPhones have been assembled by both Foxconn and Pegatron. And I think specifically Pegatron is responsible for the majority of the production of the iPhone 5C, if I'm remembering my history correctly. But I'm sure you'll let me know if I got wrong on that one. So that's sort of what we know about the new iPhone 6C. As far as the updated iPhone 6S Plus and 6S models, the main thing we're hearing is that Apple might finally move from 1 gigabyte of RAM to 2 gigabytes of RAM in those models. It's also expected that they would get an updated A9 processor. And as I mentioned earlier, that the display technology might include Apple's Force Touch technology. But as far as the size, form factor, those are expected to remain the same as the prior models. And that's pretty much what we see with the S lineup, is minor incremental upgrades. Those are in those every other year sorts of time frames and not a lot of big updates. But Apple adding a 4-inch model back into the lineup, I think, is going to be a nice welcome addition. And as far as those displays go on the new models, Japan Display is still rumored to be a major Apple display provider. And they recently confirmed plans to build a new $1.4 billion LTPS LCD plant in central Japan. And that's construction supposed to start earlier this month. And the reason that's significant is the plant is reportedly being built with a multi-billion dollar prepayment from Apple. And that plant should be producing roughly 100 million 5-inch LTPS LCD panels a year. So there had been some sort of speculation and rumors in the Apple community that at some point Apple might switch to OLED technology. But because of the investment in this plant, JP Morgan analyst Nari Chang seems to believe that Apple will be sticking with LCD technology, at least for their phones, for the foreseeable future. Many had kind of thought because Apple is using OLED finally in the Apple Watch that they may be more open and receptive to that technology. But Apple has always been big on the LTPS LCD technology for their larger screen devices, things like phones. So I think they're really going to be sticking with that technology. And this investment in Japan Display just seems to sort of back that up. One other thing that we saw this week sort of coming out of the new product rumor mill was a callback to these rumors of an iPad Pro. And this time around, there seems to be kind of a somewhat sketchy report coming from Weibo.com, which actually is a source that's proven to have leaked different product images in the past that end up being accurate. But I think just as frequently, they are inaccurate. They kind of have mock-ups or things that maybe manufacturers sort of slap together on speculation, thinking, hey, this might be a new Apple product coming out there. But there are these iPad Pro images that surfaced this week that seem to show an iPad Pro with a second Lightning connector or possibly a USB-C port. One on the side of the device and one on the edge of the device. So you've got these two ports. And we've seen this in the past where It might be capable to actually dock in landscape or portrait mode through that connector. Now, I don't put a lot of stock in this rumor. It could just be an R&D unit that we're seeing, something that Apple is playing around with. Maybe they got different ports in there because they've got a USB-C and a Lightning. Maybe they're messing around seeing, are we going to move to USB-C ports for future Apple products and iOS devices? And that's something I think very likely could happen. We've been hearing rumors to that effect, and the fact that the new MacBook supports USB-C, Apple might want to move to that one standardized connector. And the two connectors look very, very similar, which is why it's hard to tell from these Weibo images whether or not it's a USB-C port or a Lightning connector. But regardless, it's an interesting thing to think about. The image also shows some additional potential new features, things like a rear camera with a light sensor and a microphone. So Apple could be finally adding some sort of flash on the iPad Pro product. And it also shows a set of speaker holes next to the headphone jack. And a longstanding rumor surrounding an iPad Pro update is that it would get stereo speakers built into it. So most of the mock-ups, most of the leaked images or reported leaked images that we have seen show speaker grills on both sides of the product. So this particular one seems to be consistent with those prior rumors as well. I'm still of the mind that the iPad Pro is something Apple is simply playing around with. I don't know that it's an actual product. Some of the rumors are saying we might see an announcement of an iPad Pro this September. If Apple did do something like that, I think we would see maybe the Force Touch technology coming to the display so that we could see things like a pressure-sensitive stylus and what have you. So it's an interesting product to think about. Whether or not we'll see it, I think we're just going to have to keep watching this rumor and wait over the next few months. If the rumors get heavier, I think there's good odds that we might finally actually see a 12-inch iPad Pro. And then the last bit of news that I have for you this week is a little bit sad. Gary Allen, who is the editor over at IFO Apple Store, has announced that he is stopping his work on that site. And while I totally respect his decision, I am very saddened for our community because that was a top-notch site. Gary is a great journalist. He wrote what I consider to be the definitive content on and about what was happening in Apple retail. And him not doing that anymore, I think, is going to be a significant loss. As far as why he's doing it, he wrote up a blog post on his website, but he cites the fact that when he began the site, no one really focused on Apple retail. And as a matter of fact, if you remember, and this is just my own commentary on this, many people sort of thought it was a joke, Apple app entering the whole retail space. Well, now we know that they've been proven incredibly, incredibly wrong, and Gary was right to take on the job of reporting on this space. But now that Apple's had a lot of success in retail, he notes, and rightly, that there is a lot of coverage being done surrounding Apple retail in a bunch of different venues. So financial analysts are looking at it, design magazines and designers and retail design specialists and architects are looking at it. A lot of other special interest groups are looking at what Apple is doing in retail and reporting on it. And for Gary, he just wants more time to focus on his family and friends and get back to writing that is just fun. And so I think we really all get that, and I really wish him the best of luck and just want to say thanks, Gary, for all the great years of coverage over at IFO Apple Store. And I think it sounds like the site's going to remain up for its archival content, so it's not necessarily going away, but it's not going to be being actively updated for the future. And again, sad loss to the community, but totally understood. So with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. One subject I sort of broached, at least in terms of cost, was selecting an Apple Watch and an Apple Watch band. We've been talking about that on the past few episodes. I know a lot of us have been going back and forth trying to wrestle with this purchase decision. Which model are we going to get? Which bands are we going to want? Those sorts of things. And one issue that I've taken with Apple's bands is that I think they're a little bit too pricey for my blood. And I am hoping and waiting on third-party options to kind of fill out my style choices for my Apple Watch. But I guess there's also some other factors in choosing a band that I really hadn't thought about. And our friend Gary is back this week with some comments. He's actually been thinking quite a bit about the Apple Watch and the band and the materials and the combinations. And he had this stuff to say, which I thought was particularly interesting.
Hey, Adam, it's Gary. I'm just getting into your podcast about the Apple Watch and kind of the different materials and perhaps a refresh towards the holidays. And I've really been poring over like the different Apple Watches, the configurations, thinking about which one I would get, whether I even want to do a pre-order and go into the store. I think you get it shipped. I'm not sure how that works. Getting a pre-order, get it shipped, then you try it on, and you're like, ah, I not really like it. Go back to the store and exchange it. Or just wait, make an appointment, get it figured out, and then buy it. Don't know if that's an option or if you're going to have to wait for a while. So I think I'm going with the pre-order. But I was looking at the different options for materials. I know you mentioned in the podcast, like maybe they do a refresh with magnesium or some other type of material. And I really think that that's a good idea because I normally buy titanium watches because of their strength and their lightweightness. I have a watch now that is about the size of a 42 millimeter Apple Watch in a round configuration in a titanium, which is in total, including the band, 58 grams. So when I was looking at the different watches, the Apple Sport aluminum body with the Ion X glass is the lightest at 30 grams in the 42 millimeter. So that one kind of stood out to me. And where you go to the next one, the Edition, they're all stainless steel, and they're at 50 grams. That doesn't include the actual clasp or the band that goes around it. So in the Sport Edition, you would add maybe the rubberized polyelastisomer band that goes around it. And I think that adds an additional 12, maybe 20 grams at the most. It's the lightest weight. But if you add leather or something, that'll be right around the lightweightness of what I currently have. So that's really stood out to me as the differentiator between the two watches is being able to have this lightweight, easy to wear, forgettable in the sense that I don't have to think about how this is cumbersome and wear it on my wrist. So I thought I'd provide that to you as feedback, as I think in titanium could be a nice next step from aluminum, which I don't really think I have a problem with aluminum. I'm not really sure if I should have a concern, if it's going to be more likely to scratch, more likely to get banged up. I'm not that rough with my watches, so I think that's where I'm going to go. Thanks, Adam.
Thanks, Gary. You bring up a really interesting point, and something I really had not thought about was the whole weight of the thing. I think maybe because I'm not a watch wearer, typically. I've been wearing my Pebble, but I think the Pebble's actually particularly light. And what was interesting is when you sent me your comment, I had just come across a great article written by Rene Ritchie over at iMore that has tons of details about selecting the Apple Watch, including all of the weights of the bands. He also goes into the materials of the bands, where the leather is sourced from, who's manufacturing it. It is a really great piece. I will have a link to it in the show notes at mattcast.com if you want to check it out. So just go to mattcast.com, find the post for this particular episode, and there's a link. It'll say show notes in HTML. Click on that, and you will see the link there alongside this section of the notes. And what's interesting about it to me is in looking at the band weights, something I hadn't considered, it turns out that the classic buckle, the leather band with the classic buckle, is actually the lightest at 16 grams and 19 grams. That's for the 38 millimeter and the 42 millimeter watches, respectively. So obviously, the larger bands are a little bit heavier. The ones for the larger face are a little bit heavier than the ones for the smaller profile watch face. And there's some other interesting numbers in here. The white sport band, turns out, is about 10 grams heavier than the black sport band at the same face size. So, for example, in the 42 millimeter configuration, the black band is 40 grams and the white band is 51 grams. First of all, I don't know why the fluoroelastomer band is so much heavier than, say, like a leather band. But secondarily, why is the black one 10 grams, full 10 grams lighter than the white one? And then, just in case you're wondering, to give perspective, the steel link bracelet is the heaviest band, coming in at 65 grams for the 38 millimeter version and 75 grams for the 42 millimeter version. So depending upon which watch face and band combination, which material of watch, whether you go with the aluminum or the stainless steel or the gold, that's going to affect the weight of the watch and how it sits on your hand, which I think just further brings up the point that Apple's trying to make, that you probably want to try on your watch combination and the materials and things like that before you actually make your purchase. Because I guess how a watch sort of sits on your wrist and the weight of it and how it feels as you're moving your arm around and stuff like that is really important to some people. Again, I'm not a huge watch person, so I don't know if it's ever anything that I gave any kind of consideration to, but now I'm starting to question that with your comments and also in looking at Renee's article. You know, maybe this doesn't matter. At the end of the day, for me, though, I think it's ultimately going to come down to price point, and I really don't think for a first-generation Apple Watch I want to spend more than the sport band price. But it may factor in when I get the sport band. If I feel, hey, it feels a little bit too light on my wrist, I might look for a third-party band that's a little bit lighter. Or maybe if it feels heavy on my wrist, if it feels light on my wrist, I might go for one that's heavier, a band that's heavier. If it feels heavy on my wrist, I might try and find something that's a little bit lighter weight. So I really appreciate your comments, because it was really something I hadn't considered. And also, you know, you bring up a good point. If Apple is ending up bringing out some new materials in terms of the watch faces themselves in time for the holidays, some folks may wish to wait and hold off and not buy right here in April and see if Apple doesn't come out with titanium or magnesium, maybe a lighter weight watch face, if that is something that is important to you. So all things to consider, and great to know as we sort of approach the deadline of when we're actually going to have to put in a pre-order. So thanks for the feedback as always, Gary. Another thing we need to follow up on are the, and I'm not even calling them rumors now because they're basically confirmed for me, is the discussion of Retina MacBook Pro screens that have the anti-glare coatings that seem to be becoming damaged. And it seems to be a wide variation in terms of the time at which this issue starts to crop up. I've seen everything from a couple months to years or even longer. But essentially what's happening is there are these reports of owners of Retina MacBook Pros that the anti-glare coating is starting to come off. And it seems to mostly come off around the left and right edges of the screen. Also about maybe just under halfway up the screen, more toward the bottom of the display, or excuse me, rather, toward the top of the display, maybe about a third, a little more than a third of the way down from the top of the screen. And I had mentioned last episode that the images of this stuff look horrific. Like if my laptop screen, if my MacBook Pro screen looked like this, I would be extremely angry and horrified. And the people being impacted by this, I think, are. They've taken to the online communities, both at Apple, and there's also a pretty active Facebook community that is posting images and discussing this issue. And I asked, hey, is anybody in the MacCast community experiencing this? And I got several emails back, including one from Diego, who showed me some images that looked just like what I had seen posted on the web. And it is pretty bad. He has also been in contact with Apple, and unfortunately, the response they gave him was not very good. His machine is a little bit older, so it is out of the one-year AppleCare warranty. And they're essentially calling it user damage and refusing to cover any repair costs. And he noted in his email to me that in the images and things that he'd seen, 99% of all the affected displays are affected in those two areas, sort of in the black bezel area around the screen and also in the middle of the screen. Apple is telling a number of the users that the stain specifically, or the where it's wearing off in the center of the screen, is specifically due to the keyboard getting oily. And then when customers are closing the display, all of that oil on the keys is sort of rubbing off and affecting the coating on the display itself. Basically, I guess, corroding it off or something like that. And I would assume the implication is that you need to clean your keyboard more frequently, or that you need to make sure that you don't have any undue pressure, you know, pushing on the top of the screen so that it gets pushed down into those keys. And Diego, as a matter of fact, took some precise measurements with calipers, and he sent me those images as well. And in his measurement, it really looked like it wasn't the keys that were the issue. Really, it seemed to be the area around the trackpad that was creating more damage. But again, if what's happening here is that the laptop is so thin that any kind of pressure on the lid is pushing into the surface of the trackpad or the keyboard area, anything like that, and causing this material, this coating, to come off, I see that more as a design flaw in the system and not necessarily user damage. But I'm willing to accept that that's a difference in interpretation. You know, this is more like he said, she said, and it Apple seems to be not being consistent in what they're telling consumers, nor with how they're dealing with these issues. And like I said, the areas around the edges of the display also seem to be impacted. And, you know, if Apple is saying this is from sweat and oil on your hands, well, you got to grab the side of the laptop to open it up. So are you supposed to wash your hands every time you need to open up the thing? You know, really, the anti-reflective coating shouldn't be coming off with just skin oil. That's going to be something that it's going to get subjected to occasionally. I would understand if, you know, it was the kind of thing where the only people affected were people who were heavy users of, say, like hand sanitizers, because those are very alcohol based and could be more susceptible to damaging the display, or maybe using lotions and things like that. But I've asked the MacCast listeners who have written me, and they claim they don't use those sorts of products. So I don't think that's really the case. And, you know, I think Diego, and he mentions this, you know, in his opinion, this is a design flaw in Apple's relentless pursuit of thinness. And I would tend to agree. As we get thinner and thinner, elements of the keyboard and the trackpad and things can push up on the display, especially if you put it in a laptop bag, something that might be putting some pressure on the outside screen. And I know this really isn't a fix, but if you are concerned about this, I've for years used a product with every Apple laptop that I've ever purchased, and it's called the RadTech Screen Savers Sheet from RadTech. And it is this microfiber cloth that's specifically cut to the size of your notebook, and you put it in between the keyboard and the screen. And as a matter of fact, I've seen a lot of people who use that little foam sheet that Apple ships with the notebooks to kind of help protect against this issue. You put a little layer between the keyboard and the display. Really, I think Apple needs to address this issue at a larger level, but if you're concerned about your notebook, you might take a look at the RadTech screensavers. They also offer something called a sleeve with a Z that goes over the outside of your case, and I've always purchased the two together because that way when I'm putting my laptop into the laptop bag, it's in this nice microfiber sleeve, very thin. It's not taking up extra space, but it's going to protect it from anything that might be sitting on either side of the display. So if I can comfortably, say, slide in my iPad next to my notebook and not worry about the two scratching each other. So really great products. They're a little on the pricier side, but I think to protect your Apple products, they're really, really worth it. But getting back to the issue at hand, the anti-reflective coating coming off of your display, that just shouldn't be happening. And, you know, this is the kind of thing I'm a person who wears glasses, and I'm always offered that anti-glare coating stuff, and I've never had good luck with that on my lenses either, on my plastic lenses. So I don't know why it would work any better on a laptop screen. You know, that stuff is susceptible to all kinds of things. You get any kinds of oils, you use the wrong kind of cloth, it starts to scratch and flake off. And I've had glasses totally ruined by that anti-glare coating over time. So I think ultimately, hopefully, Apple will do the right thing and do a repair warranty extension program. I did receive an email from one listener who had this issue and has had luck because he's still under AppleCare. He complained to Apple, and they are going to cover the costs of the repair. So again, that inconsistency is very frustrating for consumers as well. They either need to recognize this as an issue or not recognize it. Hopefully they do the right thing and recognize it. And I'm sorry to anybody who has been impacted by this and who has been having a hard time dealing with Apple over getting repairs done. It shouldn't be this way, and Apple should stand behind that coating. If it's effective and applied correctly and it's a durable coating like it should be, this shouldn't be happening, in my opinion. One thing I get asked about quite frequently in your emails is about being an iOS developer and sort of the experience that goes on there. And luckily, we have such a great developer community inside the Apple and Mac community. We have a bunch of folks that are willing to take some time and talk to us. And Michael Simmons from Flexibits is one of those guys. He's been working in Mac and iOS software for years, as you'll hear in this interview. We've had him on the show a few times. His current company is Flexibits. You probably know them. They're the makers of Fantastic Hal. They have a new product that just came out this week that we're going to talk to him about in a little bit. But I also wanted to get him on the show because it'd been a while since we had talked to him, and we hadn't really talked recently about sort of the state of iOS and specifically the App Store, you know, marketing, getting your product on the App Store and sort of the things involved in that, what's changed, what's maybe new. So I wanted to get him on to talk about that and also to talk about the new product because I am, as you'll hear again in this interview, a big fan of Fantastic Hal. I use it on my iOS devices and I wanted to find out about the new stuff they got coming out and what's new in their new product. So, I won't waste any more time. Let's just get into the interview with Michael Simmons from Flexibits and Fantastic Hal.
Well, hey, Michael, welcome back to the MacCast. It's been a while since we had you on here.
I was gonna say, is it like almost 4 years even?
Yeah, I don't know. When did we do Fantastic Hal probably for iPad or Fantastic Hal
Well,
2 for iOS, maybe?
I'm wondering. So was it? There's no way it was the original Fantastic Hal for Mac, was it?
Yeah, I mean, we talked then too. I think over the years we've had you on from time to time.
Okay.
Yeah, just to get your opinions on things, and that's what I want to do. You know, I know you've got something new to tell us about, which is always exciting. But before we dive into that, I just want to kind of, because it has been a couple years since we've had you on. You know, usually when I get you on, I try and get, you know, because you live in that app developer space, right? And that's
Right.
not a world that I live in. I'm on the consumer side, right? I'm buying the stuff and using it and those sorts of things. And, you know, since it's been a couple of years, I'm curious to get your take, because I know I have my opinions, and I think probably the people listening have some of their opinions. But, you know, what is app development like, you know, this many years in? You know, has it
Well,
changed? What's new? What's the same? That sort of stuff.
yeah. I mean, one thing that certainly is better is I've never been more excited to make apps. You know, I've been in the app game, if you will, over 15 years
Yeah, a
now, which is
long
kind
time.
of, what's that? Exactly. And it's almost, even saying 15 years, I can't believe it. But the changes that have happened have always been great and incremental. And yeah, I mean, I feel like, especially with the iPhone and the iPad in the last 6 years, 7 years, apps are now a household word, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And
Yeah,
I
that is
think
a big change, huh?
yeah, and I think because of that, people back in the days, you know, you're old school like I am, we used to buy software in boxes, right? On disks, floppies or CDs, right?
Right, yeah.
And you know, it was a big deal. You'd go to the store and you'd pick something out and you'd unbox it and install it. Like, it was a big thing, and it really was for nerds or power users, right? The average person didn't usually buy a software. And now it's as simple as, you know, install, tapping something. And I'm bringing all this up because from a developer point of view, it increases the market that you can provide your apps to, right? So my calendar app, let's say, even if I had come up with this back in 2000, mm-hmm. the market would be so limited, not just because of devices, but because people really didn't understand how software works.
Yeah.
And now that apps are so prevalent and commonplace and just part of the vernacular, people know what an app is. Some people say, what do you do for a living? I'll be like, I'm an app developer. And they're usually really blown away, but they get it. If I had said, you know, back in 2000, you know, I developed software, they'd be like, oh, whatever. I don't know what that is.
I don't understand what that is. Yeah. Yeah. Do you think Do you think that's as much of how Apple sort of changed, you know, decided to change how software was sold in the ecosystem? Or do you think it's just more of, hey, you know, we're 15, 20 years later in technology and most people have a computer and a smartphone and a device or maybe a little bit of both?
I think it's everything. I think obviously the platforms, things like mobile devices like the iPhone and portable devices like the iPad and just the popularity of technology catching on with the internet growing and everything, mm-hmm. just a lot of perfect storm elements that at the right time, at the right place, and now more importantly with developers like myself actually making apps that people are engaged with. Just kind of, I think it was natural progression. But I will say as a developer, one of the things I'm really excited about is that things that I make, such as my own app, Fantastical, mm-hmm. there's a market that pretty much is infinite now. Now it's sort of like you're just selling to humans. You're not selling to computer nerds. Anyone with an iPhone or anyone with an iPad or anyone with a Mac is pretty much anyone nowadays, right? You can't go back. You know, if you go back 15, 20 years ago, it was a very specific type of person mm-hmm. that's probably buying a computer, right?
That's interesting to hear you say that because now I'm kind of curious, though. I mean, it sounds like what you're saying is your market is sort of wider open, more open, I guess is maybe the right way to say that.
Yeah, to some extent, that's true.
More open to a varied type of customer. I'm curious to get your take. I mean, with the ecosystem being the way it is and stuff like that, I mean, does that bring its own challenges? Like, how do you differentiate yourself or how do you, you know, find people, get to those people that, you know, may want to buy your app? Because it seems to me more and more, I mean, what you're saying is correct, but at the same time, you've got more and more apps and more people who are developers, you know, whether legitimately or just claiming to be developers and sort of that signal to noise ratio always seems to me to be growing as well. And I know it's been a challenge since the very beginning, but I'm curious, you know, has that gotten any better? Is it worse? Is it, you know, are you having to find new tricks or...
It's funny you bring up this question. Yeah. No, it's a great question. It's funny you bring it up, or a great point that someone had asked me this the other day, and they're like, you know, how do you do this when there's that many more apps and everything? And here's the way I kind of view it. The fact that there's more apps means that there's more people buying stuff, right? Because there wouldn't be a market for apps if there weren't people, right? So the fact that there's more people, that means that there's more opportunity if you're successful or if you do something that resonates with people.
Sure.
And I've always had this philosophy, and just to also answer the question of, you know, how do you rise above, is I've always been an Apple developer. Back in the early days when I started doing computers when I was younger, I had a Commodore 64 and then an Amiga. So I was definitely a Commodore fanboy by far. I mean, there was no question. I was mm-hmm. a Commodore 64, Amiga all day long. And then I got into Apple. I got into Mac. So I wasn't an Apple II, original Apple into Macintosh kind of guy. I just kind of discovered Mac after Amiga kind of went away.
Right.
And the thing is Amiga and Commodore 64 and Mac to me always just worked, right? There was never any friction. It was always that seamless thing. It was always what I liked and enjoyed using. And when I design my apps, no matter what app I've designed, whether it was at prior companies or now my own company, Flexibits, I always say what is the least resistant, you know, least friction, best user experience that you can provide for a user, because that's sure what I'd want.
Right.
And I think as Apple fans and Apple developers and people in the Apple scene like you and I are, we know that. That's why we've been using Apple so long, right? We knew it before people got it.
Sure.
So my point to answer your question is that I think, all right, so let me give you something that'll maybe kind of make it clear. A friend of mine had said, yo, man, I can't believe how great Fantastical does. Like, the success is unparalleled. And, you know, of course, I'm humbled and I'm grateful, but there's a really important message in here. He said, why? He was like, why? And I said, well, we designed a really good calendar app. Like, we really set out to solve problems and really surprise and delight people and make calendaring not only powerful, but fun.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I mean, you use our app on iPhone, for example, or on your Mac. Like, what do you think of it when you use it? It's a great experience, right? Like, you actually look forward to it, right?
Yeah. I mean, a lot in the design and the consideration that you can tell, you know, things aren't just placed somewhere just because, you know, it's what everybody else did. It's thoughtful design. It's thought. I think a big thing for me is thought in the process. Like I think I was mentioning to you earlier, I use it as my main calendar on my iOS device, because when I open the calendar, for me, I live in week view, or month view rather, excuse me. And I don't often go into week view, but I still want to be able to see sort of, you know, for a given day, what are my events? And I've got it all in that sort of split screen view with Fantastical. It's sort of right there, ready to go for me. You know, and I'm in portrait mode or whatever, what have you. Right, and, right. You know, and that's sort of the place I live in. I also was very impressed, and I know other calendars do this now, but you guys, in my mind, sort of pioneered the idea of real text entry. So to be able to just
natural language parsing.
To write out a sentence and have that parse and do it really well and work really well. And I know you guys worked really hard on that, because I think I was helping you out in the beta program way back when you were developing that. And I was just blown away by that feature. So, you know, those sorts of things, I mean, that goes to what you were talking about in terms of sort of taking away friction. But, and I think we as Mac users get that, but you think that carries over into this sort of larger market where, you know, you're talking about, which is, this isn't just tech nerds anymore. So a lot of the stuff you do appeals to me because it's very techy, nerdy. You know, I can kind of see the craftsmanship and also a little bit of the technology that's happening behind the scenes.
That's right.
But
well, you know you what? Know. Techie nerds respect, acknowledge, and identify what we've done in terms of the details and the awesomeness, right?
Right.
Regular people don't, but when they're using it, they know it isn't painful.
Right.
And I think this is a really big distinction that app developers, I hope, take note of, is that you may say, oh, someone isn't going to care. But I tweeted something the other day where I said, if you don't care about the details, what makes you think your users are going to care about your app?
Right.
And I think it's so important that if you get these details right, nerdy people, techie people will take note. But people who don't take note or don't even care, they will still have a much better experience. They may not know why or they may not care why, but it will show in the usage or adoption of your product.
Yeah, it's kind of that undercurrent thing that's going on. So two follow-up questions to that, and then I want to get into, you know, your new product.
Sure.
So, you know, there is that undercurrent, but still then, I mean, how do you, there's still that problem of how do you get that message that, you know, how do you get people to try the app? How do you get people to even have that experience, right? I think that's something that a lot of developers struggle with in the current app ecosystem, because you're thrown in that app pool with everything. And now you've got to rise to the top. I know some of it probably comes from people who have used your apps before, but what about that person that's just, you know, I just bought my iPhone or my iPad, I need a calendar, and I'm not happy with the one Apple provides, or I want something a little bit more, and they just, you know, how are you getting to that person?
Yeah, so it's also a good question, and it sort of goes back to what my friend had asked me about, how are you so successful? In other words, how do people find you and all this stuff, especially right. We're indie developers, and we don't spend a lot of money, if not any, on marketing or advertising. And, you know, sure, we're growing now and maybe we should, but I've always had this passion, Panic, actually, I'm sure you know them very well.
Yep.
Not only great friends, but they're also, I would say, very inspirational to me. You know, they sort of set that bar of regular guys, indie guys, you know, not a big company, just a couple of regular Joes can make great apps and people will buy them, right? And you don't need to advertise, because they're very much like us. They don't advertise. I mean, right. Maybe every now and then they'll sponsor something here and there, but they kind of try to separate out the business from the reality. So we get, for example, we get pinged all the time for sponsors and we technically don't do it. It's not because we don't want to support them. It's that we want to leave out the bias, right? If we're supporting something all the time, then it sort of adds an element of, wow, is our app really good or isn't it? We want our app to stand on its own, right? Not because we advertised. And I know that's sort of obviously a controversial topic, but it goes back to what you just said. You know, how do you get the word out? And the way you get the word out is the product's really good. And it may sound like a cliche, but we just made a really stellar app. And, I don't say it cocky. I say it now because I have enough users telling me it's stellar that I feel pretty confident in saying it's stellar. But my point is actually one data point I'd love to brag about. We have a perfect 5-star rating on our iPhone app on the App Store. Yes, the App Store has a perfect 5-star rating out of like hundreds of reviews, which is bonkers.
Yeah.
But that's it. So I always tell people, you know what marketing is? Your app. Make your app so good that people take note and tell other people, and reviewers and podcasters and everyone talk about it because it's such a great app, and let the app sell itself.
Yeah. Yeah,
and it sounds so like I said, cliche or ridiculous, but I think the results speak for themselves, right?
Well, yeah, and it's funny because some people will say, "Well, that sounds simple," but it's so not. That's the thing, you know. They think, "Well, that's wow, I just have to make a good app." Well, so yeah, we talk, right.
You know about my last week's real simple. I mean,
yeah, but again, because it goes deeper, it's not just because I think a lot of people when they think, "Oh, you know, make a really good app." They immediately parse that into, oh, well, I just have to hire a really good designer, or, you know, it just has to be really easy to use, or it just has to be, you know, like they have an idea of what that is. And the problem is it's all those things, and it's even deeper than that, right?
Exactly.
It's, you know, really thoughtfully thinking about every little nuance, and it's what Apple does so well. And I think why, you know, again, their products continue to sell and people talk about, you know, they're overpriced or whatever, you know, negatives they want to try and throw on it. But at the end of the day, the customers recognize the value because of all of the little tiny things that you either notice or you don't notice.
The sum of all the parts, as I like to say.
Yeah. And it's sort of like you said about, you know, that customer that maybe isn't a tech nerd and doesn't understand, you know, that you built this giant natural language parsing engine, but they do get that, oh, it's really easy for me to put my calendar event into this
app. My wife has a lot of friends that'll tell her, like it was kind of ironic because a couple of people like, your husband makes fantastic, Al. It was pretty cool. Right? It was like a celebrity moment, but I guarantee they don't see the details. I guarantee they don't know about the engine. I guarantee they don't know about the little tricks we put in to make things faster and friendlier, right?
Right.
But what they do is they open it up, they press plus, their event goes in, and they don't have to worry about it. And again, that is it. That's the secret sauce. The sauce is just like with Apple, the user experience is everything. And if you make an app that you have your users' best, you know, intentions in mind, best intentions of users, you're going to make a great app, hopefully. And if you do, users are going to eat it up and love it. And then, as I said, so just to kind of answer your question, one more part is then bloggers are going to talk about it and people are going to post about it and 5-star reviews are going to show up and Apple's going to take note of it and go, wow, this app's selling well. Let's feature them. Right. Mm-hmm. And you'll be talking about it. And then my, you know, someone like my wife's friend will be talking about it and organically. And this is the key, Adam, organically, that app will have legs. So now when someone goes onto Google and types best iPhone calendar, I guarantee it's probably coming up in a search because someone talked about it.
Right. All right. The one other quick item I just want to ask you about, and you don't have to, I'm not asking you this directly about what you're doing with your apps.
Sure.
We can talk about it in a roundabout way, but obviously, you know, Apple Watch is around the corner.
Yep.
Just in general, as a developer, you know, how do you feel about Apple Watch and the platform and things at this point?
Yeah, so without revealing plans.
Just in general. I mean,
yeah, sure.
When you
I
saw
love
the
talking
keynote
about it.
And with what's available to you guys as developers, is it something that excites you? Is it
definitely. I mean,
and what are you excited about?
Very well. So first of all, I'm excited about it because I think Apple's doing it in the right way. Everyone can point fingers just the way, as I said, someone says, well, you know, you're just a calendar app. Why is it so successful, right? Mm-hmm. Well, they're just a watch, quote unquote, right? Like the thing is that Apple shares the same philosophy with me. Well, I guess I share it with Apple in that you make something really good, you make it just work and you make it better than it's ever been, right? Mm-hmm. And the Apple Watch is that, right? Yes, this is 1.0 and yes, this is not going to be the best. And yes, there's going to be things wrong and limitations and oddities and who knows what, right? But it's going to be a device that you're going to put on your wrist, and I guarantee the interactions and the, you know, glances and notifications and all the things you get, right? I guarantee they're going to be incredibly helpful and people are going to fall in love with it. And then we'll see what 2.0 brings and 3.0 and all that. But what excites me about it is another platform to potentially help people's lives.
Right.
I was just
going to ask you, in the developer community at large, have you experienced, because I am in a small developer group, so I can maybe answer this after you give your answer, because I think I know what it is, but I want to hear from you.
Sure.
As you're out and talking to developers, is there anybody you're encountering that isn't excited about the Apple Watch? Have you ever heard a developer sort of say, eh?
No, I don't think so. For me personally, I'll tell you, I'm very, there's one thing I'm different than, because I've gotten into debates with my developer friends over this, but and I guess I can say this. So we're not going to have an Apple Watch app from day one.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that is, as I said to you with making an app, I feel you need to solve a problem and I feel you need to do it in a really great way.
Mm-hmm.
And right now I haven't used the Apple Calendar Watch app, right?
Sure.
Apple Watch Calendar app. And I haven't, nor have I used the Apple Watch Reminders app, right? Nor have I experienced how it works. So let's say hypothetically, Apple has, now keep in mind that the Apple Watch is a different experience, right? Because the Apple Watch is basically a notification center on your wrist.
Mm-hmm.
It's not meant to do a lot of work with, right? It's supposed to be very small, quick bursts.
Sure.
So what if Apple, their calendar just works great? What if the Reminders app just works great? What if there's no problem to solve? Should we just have a fantastic Cal on the watch just to say that there's a fantastic Cal on the watch? That's not what I would ever sell. So for me, being there day one, I would love to be there day one, but without having a device. And, you know, Apple's been great. I have to say their development tools and their documentation and everything they've shown, I can definitely put myself into it. I mean, I see what they're doing and I could definitely come up with ideas, and we already are coming up with ideas. And I will say this, we will probably have something very close after launch.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, I need to experience it to understand the problem and spend time with the problem to try to see. First of all, there might not be a problem. This sounds crazy, but let me tell you something that you may not know. I think we may have talked about it when I was on in the past.
Mm-hmm.
But did you know that Fantastical for iPhone, and I'm trying to pull it up quick while I'm talking. Did you know Fantastical for iPhone didn't come out until November 29th, 2012? So the point is that the first version of Fantastical shipped on May 17th, 2011. So it wasn't until over a year and a half later that our iPhone app came out. And keep in mind that in May 2011, the iPhone was rolling. So why didn't we have an iPhone app for a year and a half? Answer, we didn't want to just make Fantastical for iPhone. In other words, we didn't want to make an iPhone app for the sake of making an iPhone app. We wanted to make the best version we could fixing a problem that existed. And then, I don't know if you know this, but when we came out, we actually hit number one of the entire app store, which for a productivity paid premium, paid productivity app to hit number one of all apps is like, out of bounds.
Right.
So back to the philosophy is because we solved the problem. So when it came out, people went nuts over it and went, wow, and everyone talked about it and, you know, went up. So we want to do the same with the Apple Watch. And, you know, again, we're not doing it to hit number one in the ranks. In fact, you know, Apple Watch apps, I think you know this, they use the iPhone app as a carrier.
Right. Yeah.
You don't download. Yeah. So, you know, okay, sure, we might sell more copies of our iPhone app, but let's be honest, at the end of the day, we're catering probably to our existing users with an Apple Watch app.
Sure.
But we want to make it the best version of Fantastical for Apple Watch, and therefore we need to spend time on it and really try to figure out what we need to do to make our users' lives better.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. That makes a lot of sense.
All right, cool.
So, cool. So, yeah, let's talk about the new product. So you guys launched Fantastical 2.
On March 25th.
For Mac.
Yes. And I need a crystal ball at this point. But yeah, no, Fantastical 2 for Mac. This really is the biggest project I've ever worked on. So Flexibits is just two guys. It's me and my business partner, Kent Sutherland.
Mm-hmm.
And we do have a couple contractors we work with. Wolfgang Bartelme helps us with design. He helps us with the visuals. He makes the app look really beautiful. And we have a friend of ours in Germany that's also helping us out with some code. But just a couple guys. And that also means a lot of responsibilities. And I think really this was the hardest project we've done, certainly for myself, because this is taking Fantastical 1 for Mac, the baby that started it all, right? The thing that made Fantastical Fantastical.
Right.
And reinvents it.
Yeah. Now, this is ambitious, right? Because this isn't a small update.
It's risky, right? Like, I mean, during before launch, a bunch of the press people actually said, wow, what a risk you're taking. You know, messing with success, so to speak. Because it's true, right? You have a proven ingredient, chemistry, equation, right?
Yeah.
Let me say this. We didn't intentionally say, hey, how do we change Fantastical to make it new?
Mm-hmm.
What people don't see, and for you to some extent, right? Because you only saw one and then boom, I'm showing up with two, right?
Right.
You didn't see that process of almost 3 years of development in between. So, okay, Fantastical 1 was started in 2010, came out in 2011. And then, of course, work started eventually on iPhone and iPad, right? And mm-hmm. Fantastical 2 for iPhone for iOS 7. But Fantastical 2 for Mac has easily been in development for 3 years. The overall, we have to make Fantastical better. What do we do, right? All of those years, all of those steps, all of those things obviously was a great evolution, reinvention of Fantastical. So we really thought about everything. We didn't just change it for the sake of changing it. We changed it for the sake of making it better. And I think at first people see it as, wow, I can't believe they're changing this. But then as I followed up, they say they love it.
Well, you want to tell people what's new? Because I think it's very significant.
Yeah. I think that's an understatement, right?
Yeah, yeah. It is an understatement. So let them in on what they're going to see when they buy it.
Thanks. Well, I appreciate that. Well, one of the first big things we did is we are only for OS X Yosemite now. So we don't support any other versions. We're exclusively for OS X Yosemite. And of course, our beautiful all-new design is exclusively for OS X Yosemite. Now, we had been working on the design before Yosemite came out. But it just, in fact, we were working on the design technically before iOS 7 came out, before the whole flat trend came out. Mm-hmm. And we were already making it. So if you look at Fantastic Hell 1 even now, which is kind of weird because we came out with Fantastic Hell 1 in the peak of the skeuomorphism thing, It's pretty flat. Yes, there are skeuomorphic elements, but overall, if you still look at Fantastic Hell 1 today, knowing all the stuff you've seen with iOS 7 and Yosemite, it still looks good. It fits in. And that's because I think we've always done kind of a very clean design. We didn't ever try to garnish, you know, put too much garnish on things.
Right.
So point is, though, Yosemite made it really easy to make better decisions because now it really blends into the OS. But big features, the biggest feature, I would say, the thing that I think everyone is shocked about is we have a full calendar window now with day, week, month, and year views.
Yeah, Fantastical doesn't just live in my menu bar anymore.
That's right. But I do want to remind
you. That's huge.
I do want to remind
you. Both in scale and just in.
Yeah, I know. It's true. Feature. But I do want to remind everyone that the mini window is not gone. And this, you know this as well because you still use it. The mini window will always be the heart of Fantastic Hell. The parsing engine will always be the heart of Fantastic Hell. That quick access in the menu bar, that's the gift, right? That's what makes it great. But you're not always just in Safari, let's say, adding an event. Sometimes you want to go focus on your calendar and really dig down deep, right? Mm-hmm. And that's where the full calendar window comes into play. So as you know, there's a day, week, month, and year view, really beautiful views and really helpful user interface there. Because we support OS X Yosemite, we have a today widget, an action extension, a share extension, handoff support between the Mac, iPhone, and iPad versions, which is really great. So if you're on your iPhone, you're looking at an event, you come back, you want to continue on your Mac, opens right up to that event.
Yep.
Got full iCloud reminder support. I'm sure you know that we've always had reminder support on Mac, but they're really advanced now with support for geofence, location-based reminders, and a full list. So you can see all of your reminders on a separate list. We now have location maps, full time zone support. The parser's been improved to handle things like adding alerts and also having much, much more flexible repeating events. And the two biggest features I'm actually the most proud of next to the full window, first of all, is calendar sets.
Yeah,
I'm sure you're familiar with those. Yeah. What do you think of those? I mean, maybe it'd be better to hear your take on it since you really understand.
I think it's great. I think, you know, we talked earlier, I'm not a huge calendar power user. So, you know, it's not as big a feature for me, but I see the potential of this for a lot of people who, you know, if you have a lot of calendars, basically you can create little sets to collect your calendars into logical groups. So I work at home, so this wouldn't affect me, but say I had a work calendar and different work calendars at work and I had ones at home, now I can put them into different sets. And what's really cool, what really impressed me, because you have the location stuff in there, is I can have it switch sets automatically when I'm moving between locations.
Precisely. So yeah. Yeah, calendar sets basically let you instantly toggle multiple calendars with a single click because it's part of a group. You're changing a group of calendars, not just one calendar at a time.
Right.
And as you said,
it's really handy.
It's the feature that really makes me so excited is the location-based calendar set. So you're at work, boom, the work set comes up. You go back home, now your home set comes up, and you can focus on just the right calendars at the right time.
Right.
So yeah, we're really proud of that one. And another one I'm very proud of is our Japanese support. So our parser has always understood English, French, German, Italian, and Spanish, which every language we add is a massive, massive project because it's not just the user interface. That's pretty easy.
Right.
It's the parsing engine needs to truly speak and understand a language, right?
Mm-hmm.
So as I said, we've always had English, French, German, Italian, and Spanish, but for the first time ever, and I speak Japanese a bit, so it's really exciting for me, and I've been doing business in Japan a while, and I love Japan. We're adding full Japanese support for Fantastic Hell 2 for Mac. So Japanese parsing comprehension, the user interface, the App Store localizations, even our website, we've added Japanese pages to for full support in Japanese.
You know, another thing that I really like and appreciate, and I think this has always kind of been there, but I've just noticed it more in the full calendar, is you have like address parsing. So if I'm putting in a location for an event that I need to go to, it seems to be parsing that and finding that. And I don't know if you're pulling data out of maps or you're pulling data out of my address book, but it has made address book entry, you know, a lot easier.
Yeah. And the parsing engine really has just gotten a lot better. We've taken, so Fantastic Owl 1, we always were trying to push and make the parsing better. But then Fantastic Owl 1 for iPhone came out, made it a bit better. Fantastic Owl 2 for iPhone came out, made it better. Fantastic Owl 2 for iPad came out, made it better. And it wasn't easy to just port these things over to the Mac and just update the parsing engine. I mean, we could have, but then there's a lot of implications. And we were already building Fantastic Owl 2 for Mac. So trying to take time to get the parsing engine updated for one while we're not shipping the new one isn't really a good service to users, right? And then especially if there's issues and let's say other problems, now we've wasted time, right? So we really do try to be efficient with shipping. But now Fantastic Owl 2 for Mac has the absolute best parsing engine we've ever had. And of course, now those improvements will come to iPhone and iPad very shortly. And when I say very shortly, like within weeks. And you know, it won't even be like necessarily a feature. Our parsing engine should always just be better, right? It should just always work. And that's sort of our expectation, is that you never really think about the parsing engine getting better or not. It just sort of always works for you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, yeah. So that's it. So big update, really lots of features. Yeah. Thank you.
So picking it up, people, it's on the App Store.
Yeah, Mac App Store, and also from our direct Flexibit store. We have a Flexibit store powered by FastSpring. They're great. They're like a really good, you know, partner for software.
Now, are there any differences if I buy one versus the other? Or because, you know, that comes up in some apps, so you don't have any sandboxing issues or anything like that?
No, there's one tiny difference between our version and the Mac App Store version. I'll tell you what it is. It's very insignificant, but the Mac App Store version uses MapKit, which actually allows the maps to appear, you know, via Apple Maps.
Okay.
When you're not on the Mac App Store, you can't show MapKit because it, you know, they don't want anyone just using their API. So you have to be a registered developer. Gotcha. So on the direct one, we're using a third party map called Mapbox, and Mapbox maps leverage. I'm trying to say it's
OpenStreetMap.
Yeah, OpenStreetMaps. Thank you. Exactly. Yeah. So you know what it is.
Yeah.
So
good stuff. Still.
Mapbox is great, and OpenStreetMap is great. Reason why we went with the MapKit for the Mac App Store is that's what people expect, right? People expect Apple Maps. So just we would have loved to put in our direct app. We understand why. And at the end of the day, no one's going to notice. But that is the only difference.
Yeah. I think the version that I've been using has the OpenStreetMap ones. And honestly, I didn't notice till you just kind of mentioned it. So, I mean, they look very similar. When I click through, it's still opening, you know, Apple Maps. And so...
Yeah, I shouldn't even mention it because it's one of those things, seriously, no one sees it, but I always believe in truth in advertising. So, yeah, that's the only difference, and there's no difference. There's just none. As you said, you click it, and it still opens in Apple Maps, so it's fine.
So it's just a matter of preference where you want to buy your app.
Exactly. And just to give pricing, I think you probably want that next.
Sure.
So it's $49.99 for the app, but we're doing a launch special for $39.99. We're giving a discount, basically. The impetus for that discount amount was to kind of give previous Fantastic Owl 1 owners some kind of credit for their purchase, you know, to give them an upgrade price.
Sure.
And unfortunately, with the Mac App Store, you can't target specific pricing or give specific discounts to prior customers. So we just have to give it to everyone, which is fine. You know, a launch sale is always nice too. But we definitely did the launch sale not just to have a sale at launch. In fact, we really debated not doing a sale. We were like, why do a sale? Just launch it. But we do think, especially as us buying stuff as consumers, it's always nice to have some kind of credit if you bought a prior version and you've supported the developer, so everyone gets a discount.
Cool.
And that's about it. Yeah.
Thank you. And obviously give the website, and then if people want to follow you or Flexibits, you guys got Twitter or social media stuff?
Yeah, sure. So our website is flexibits.com. That's FlexiBits.com. Or on the Mac App Store, you can just obviously search for Fantastic Owl. Mm-hmm. Or on the iOS App Store, Fantastic Owl. We have an iPad and an iPhone separate version, but you already know that. And then on Twitter, we're at Flexibits. Again, FlexiBits. And I'm at Mac Guitar, MacGuitar. We're also on Facebook, Facebook.com/Flexibits.
Awesome. Thank you so much again, Michael, for your time.
Yeah, you're welcome. And thanks always for the kind words and support. You know, as I said, we do what we do for our users. So whenever I hear someone loving my app or using it or being supportive of it, keeps me going.
Great. Thanks. Well, hopefully we can keep Michael going a bit longer because Fantastic Owl 2 is out in the App Store, like he mentioned, and it is, of course, getting great reviews really good stuff, well thought out. One thing I like about Flexibits and Michael too is they're very responsive developers. They listen to the community. You can reach out to them. You can give them feedback, and they really solicit that feedback. And they want honest feedback. They want to know what's good as well as what's not good, so that they actually can improve the product and make it better. And we have a lot of developers like that in our community. So I want to thank him for taking the time to come on the show and talk to us about, you know, iOS development and the new product. So the last item I have for you normally would be our thing of the moment, but I think for thing of the moment, I have to pick Fantastical 2 for the Mac. I've been using it. I love the look. I love a lot of the new features. I'm still playing around with it, so it's going to take some time before I get into all of the nitty-gritty, but I think another fantastic job by the folks at Flexibits, and I think you really should check it out. So I'm going to pick that. But because I'm picking that and we had the great interview with Michael, I also want to give you one more item, and I'm going to do that in the form of a quick tip. Apparently, Craig Hockenberry of Icon Factory and Twitterific has somehow been able to infiltrate Apple's iOS development team and slip in what I would consider his own personal sort of quick type Easter egg feature. I really don't think Craig did this, but those of you who know or follow Craig Hockenberry know that he is famous for something called the Chalk Lock, which is basically, you know, typing in all caps on Twitter. And I actually learned about this little trick from the guys over at Cult of Mac, so credit to them. I'll have a link to their original article in the show notes at maccast.com. But what this is that if you use iOS and you use the QuickType feature, turns out you can quickly select an individual word that you've typed in and quickly convert that to all caps. So if you want to do some quick yelling at someone in an iOS app where you're doing some typing, this is how you do it. The first thing you need to do is make sure that you do have QuickType enabled. So as long as you see those three little suggestions pop up as you're typing at the top of the keyboard, you do have QuickType turned on. The easy way to flick it on if you don't have it set up is just to sort of slide up, swipe your finger up at the top of the keyboard, and the QuickType options should pop back up. So as long as they're there, you can select any word that you just typed. Now, unfortunately, you can only do this one at a time. You can't do a whole selection of a sentence. But one word at a time, you can select the word, and a quick way to do that is simply double tap on the word, and it should select the whole word. And then when that is selected, if you just double tap on the shift key, the QuickType options will show you that word, but in all caps, and then you can tap it and quickly convert it to all caps and have it replaced. And luckily, this trick also works in reverse. So if you have something that you accidentally typed out in all caps, you don't want it in all caps, double tap it, double tap the shift key, and it will give you the option in the QuickType options to convert it to all lowercase. So great little quick tip, and I thought it was kind of interesting and funny considering the whole tie-in with the Chalk Lock. So I wanted to share that with you. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors: Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, also Text Expander Touch for your iOS devices, along with PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can find out more information and details on all of their great software over at smilesoftware.com. I'd also like to thank Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth by going to gazelle.com. And lynda.com. Lynda.com helps you learn and keep up to date with your software, pick up brand new skills, or explore new hobbies with their easy-to-follow video tutorials. You can get a free 10-day trial by going to lynda.com/maccast. That's lynda.com/maccast. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. All of the bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cacheFly.com. And advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They're at backbeatmedia.com. As always, if you have any feedback for me, a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send me email. The email address is maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to leave voicemail on the listener hotline. That telephone number is 281-622-4269, 281 MacIam9. Or if you prefer Skype, you can leave a voicemail there. My Skype address is TheMacCast. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That is maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And then lastly, you'll find me on social media. If you want to follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast. You can also check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. And if you're a Google Plus user and prefer that platform, you can find the MacCast Google Plus community. Just search for MacCast on Google Plus and you will find us there. Still hoping someday that they'll give us some sort of short URL for that, but that has not happened yet for communities, only personal accounts. So just do your Google search and you should be good to go there. But with that, that's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.